Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting.
Indeed, today is the day. It is Wednesday, May the 15th, 2019. I've been asking you, where in the Word are you today? Today seems a good day to consider Matthew 24 in terms of where in the Word we might find ourselves. You are going to hear today, let me just warn you in advance if you haven't already, you're going to hear some saber rattling. You are going to hear that Iran is ordering its diplomatic personnel to withdraw from some places. You are going to hear that the United States and others are anticipating an escalation in the Middle East. You are going to hear that drone warfare is now actively being engaged, and nation states are seeking to demonstrate who is actually responsible for such things. So you're going to hear about wars and rumors of wars today. It's upon us. You're very likely going to hear today that nations are rising against nations, kingdoms against kingdoms. You are likely to hear today about famines and earthquakes in various places. And so Matthew 24 is a good place for us to find ourselves today. Where in the Word are you today? Jesus left the temple. He was walking away when his disciples came up to him, calling his attention to this magnificent building, which, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, even what only now remains of the Temple Mount is quite extraordinary to behold. And Jesus asks them, do you see all these things? Truly, I tell you, not one stone here will be left upon another. Everyone will be thrown down. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. Tell us when this will happen. What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age? Now, it's interesting, I think, that they recognize that when Jesus is talking about the physical temple in Jerusalem being brought low, he is also talking about his second coming, which is, I think, curious to note. When will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming, the end of the age? Jesus answered them, "Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming I am the Messiah, and will destroy many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen. The end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains," which means labor, which means a process of birth. And so I think that when we consider these things, when we consider that life is difficult, when we consider that things are not getting progressively better, as some would like to imagine, we need to remember, we need to find ourselves in Matthew 24, picking up again at verse 9. "Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death." I don't know about you, but I'm not sure that that we are proclaiming this part of the gospel to everyone today when we are promising them their best life now. The reality is Jesus was really clear that in this life, we would, as Christians, be handed over to be persecuted and put to death. "You'll be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. Many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations. And then the end will come." So, friends, this is the word of the Lord. And this word we keep in mind as we walk as people of faith into the very realities that Jesus described right here in Matthew 24. So do not lose heart. Stand firm. Walk by faith. Bear light. Love others with loving kindness and mercy, serving as a living demonstration of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world, pointing to the reality of the king and the kingdom, which never pass away. In fact, indeed, are coming again. So how do we articulate all of these things of the faith, to emerging generations in order that all the world may know? Well, that is actually the subject of my conversation next with Sean McDowell on his new book, So the Next Generation Will Know. That's up next here on Mornings with Carmen. Joining us here on Mornings with Carmen, I am joined in conversation by Sean McDowell. He is a best-selling author, co-author, and editor of more than 18 books, including Is God Just a Human Invention? He is a professor of apologetics at Talbot School of Theology, Biola University, and he blogs regularly at seanmcdowell.org. He's here to talk with us today about his new book, co-authored with J. Warner Wallace. The book is So the Next Generation Will Know. Sean, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Good morning, Carmen.
It's great to have you here. Love to read what you're writing and love the way that you're engaging the next generation. And that's specifically what we're talking about today. I think it's one thing for us to, you know, sort of have an understanding of the faith ourselves and even how to talk with our peers about it. But when we start seeking to encourage the next generation to believe what we believe, to share our understanding, we have to actually understand who they are before we can communicate with them about what we believe. So talk a little bit about Gen Z, because I think there are a lot of folks who probably don't even have in their minds who Gen Z is yet. And then we can talk about some characteristics of that generation.
Sure. Gen Z are basically those elementary school through, say, college age. So millennials are gone. They have moved on like previous generations have. When you talk about like junior high, elementary, high school, and really up to about 22, maybe 23, depending exactly how you characterize it, that's this new generation of Gen Z. So some have dubbed them, say, for example, iGen or the post-millennials or the trans generation. But the name that is really stuck is Gen Z. That's the generation we're talking about.
And when you think about communicating the gospel or translating the gospel to this new generation, when you think about preparing them, what are some of like the critical things that we need to know about Gen Z in order for us to be sort of good translators of the gospel to the next generation?
Well, in the book, J. Warner Wallace and I have just done extensive research on this generation and give about a dozen insights that are unique to them. And I think there's a few in particular that stand out that are helpful. Number one is just to know emotionally that this is a generation. The studies are increasingly showing there's higher loneliness, higher depression, higher anxiety. And this is true for the culture as a whole, but also for this generation. Relationally, there's a brokenness for many of them. But second, probably the biggest factor really is that this is the first truly digital generation. They're digital natives in the sense. So millennials, Xers like myself have learned to use it, but many in this generation were swiping iPhones and tablets before they could even speak or read or communicate in a broader fashion. Their brains and relationships and everything about the way they see the world is shaped through this digital technology. So when we talk about relating to them, when we talk about communicating the gospel to them and discipling them, we have to see it through this lens of how this technology just shapes so many facets of their lives.
And they're incredibly diverse. I mean, they are more diverse than any prior generation. And they think in a way that is that's genuinely pluralistic. Like they are asking different questions than my generation was asking. Am I correct?
Yes, I think you're right about that. They're certainly diverse racially, for example. This is the last majority white generation. The next generation, whatever we double them, will be majority white. And what's interesting is this generation only really notices diversity when it's not there. So even members of this generation who have grown up in more homogenous communities experience the nature of diversity through the media and through online. They see it. Now, when it comes to the questions they're asking, what Jim and I do in the book, So the Next Generation Will Know, is we list some things that are timely, and some things that are timeless. So there are certain timeless questions that your generation asked, my generation asked, every generation asks. For example, like, why is there evil and suffering? That's a timeless question that'll always be there. But some more timely questions for this generation are really, say, the intersection between science and faith. That's a big question for this generation. Questions of like, how can Jesus be the only way? Because inclusion has become such a big virtue. To say Jesus is the only way seems exclusive. And I think questions of related to the LGBTQ conversation are very personal for this generation. And they're such a big part of the larger conversation that's taking place culturally.
Okay, so tell us how in this book you guys are really equipping us to address some of those specific concerns.
Well, this is a real practical guide. It's not a why book. If you want to learn how to think Christianly about these different topics, you can go get some of those different resources that are out there. We've written some of those. This is a how-to book with practical guides and advice and strategies for parents, for youth pastors, for Christian school teachers, for educators, really for any caring adult who looks at this generation and says, how do I understand them and where do I start? And we have 8 chapters, and each chapter is framed in the sense of love. Love relates, love understands, love equips, love trains. We walk through the uniqueness of the generation, how to motivate them, how to equip them, and how to practically train them as opposed to simply teaching them biblical truth.
So one of my favorite things is all of the stuff in the margins. Like, this is a book that's marginally good, in addition to being like good in its just substance and content. What you guys have done in the margins is really stimulating and helpful and practical, and it's written directly to, you know, various and different people who might be trying to engage in this material and engage young people with this material. So I really appreciated that as well. I love the show me section. And I'm wondering if when we come back, we can talk about some of the proven strategies and then the tools that you guys are really offering in this book to equip us to equip the next generation with the truth. The book is So the Next Generation Will Know: Preparing Young Christians for a Challenging World. Sean McDowell is here. He co-authors the book with J. Warner Wallace, and we'll be right back. Returning to our conversation now with Sean McDowell about his new book, So the Next Generation Will Know: Preparing Young for a Challenging World. Sean, again, you co-authored this with J. Warner Wallace. What specifically do you feel like he brings to this conversation? I mean, you just bring so much practical wisdom and the engagement with next generation people, and we're familiar with your work. For those who are not familiar with J. Warner Wallace, you know, whet their appetite for what he brings to this work.
Well, J. Warner Wallace is a cold case detective. He's never lost a case in a quarter century, all over Nightline, Dateline. And he was really pretty hardcore, for lack of a better word, or maybe he's just a committed atheist till he was 35, was dragged to church, heard the gospel, and decided to apply forensic science to the question of the reliability of the gospel of Mark. Ends up becoming a Christian. Long story short, after that, he very quickly decides he wants to be a youth pastor and start influencing the next generation. Well, as he starts off being a youth pastor, he gets rid of all his like detective kind of apologetic training. And his entire first year is like, I'm going to use candles and experience and use art. And he goes, Sean, by Thanksgiving, all of my students, all of them, had abandoned the faith. So he goes back and reconstitutes and says, maybe I need to teach kids what the Christian faith is, how to defend it, how to understand it, and started going back to what he loves, kind of apologetics and worldview and training, and really just had a transformational youth ministry experience. So we're of different generations, and he has this detective background, yet he's one of my best friends. And we just thought, you know what, let's come together and both contribute from our unique experiences, our unique research, our unique insight, a love for this generation, and write this practical guide for parents and for youth pastors and anyone who cares about the next generation.
So, Sean, I'm actually a person that loves the appendices of a book, and the appendices of this book is worth the price of the book. Tell people what's in the appendices, because this is awesome. What's in the appendix of this book is just great.
Well, there's a few appendices back there. One is just the best resources that we know of, practical, just kind of plug and play resources for working with this generation. So youth pastor, parent, homeschool families looking for a curriculum to use, books, conferences to send their kids to. This is our experience and research. Here's the best ones. The other thing that's back there is we have these kind of conversational surveys that we have both used and kind of helped create a little bit. And a lot of it comes from our friend Brett Kunkel as well. And they're basically take students on college campuses. And these are surveys that just get kids out to have spiritual conversations with students on campus. It's not necessarily doing evangelism. It's just questions like, do you think God exists? Why or why not? Do you think there's life after death? Who do you think Jesus was? Et cetera. And it's a practical, easy tool to use to get kids kind of in the game, living out their faith and engaging others. So we put those surveys in the back as an easy way. Parents could just copy them and then go use them with their own kids.
Okay, I'd love for you to differentiate between teaching and training, because I felt like this was sort of the point in the book where I had a little bit of an aha moment. I would have historically described myself as a teacher. I think what I really want to be is a trainer. And so talk about the difference in those two ideas, and then tell people what the TAB training model is.
So what we mean by teaching versus training is teaching is imparting truth and knowledge to anybody, including the next generation, on any topic. Training is when you have a goal in mind and you start to prepare hard for that goal in mind. So take a boxer. A boxer doesn't just get in shape because the boxer wants to get in shape. It's because they have on the calendar a certain date. I have this fight and I want to win. I don't want to get embarrassed. I want to be the best. So that date that's there starts them to train with that goal in mind. So typically youth ministry is just focused on teaching kids, but it's not training. So both of us, my co-author and I, started putting on the calendar dates where we would go to Berkeley and engage with atheists, dates we go to Salt Lake City and have conversations with, say, Mormons. And then when we tell students in 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 3 months, we are going to this experience and you're going to be talking to atheists about the existence of Jesus, all of a sudden we're not just teaching them truth. We are training them to get in the game and put and really use this practice. So that's a model that can shift how an entire youth ministry or even family approaches discipling their kids. Now, the TAB is theology, apologetics, and belief. It's a simple kind of acronym that my co-author came up with, that we need to teach our kids certain theological truths and understandings. We need to show them why those beliefs are true in apologetics. And then the B, beliefs, how this transforms their behavior in the way that we live. So sometimes we just talk about behavior. Sometimes we just talk about theology. But scripture, like you read the book of Romans, Paul gives theology. And then he shows how it's supposed to transform as you work through the letter, our relationships with God, relationships with other people, relationships with the world. So that's a simple model that both of us use to varying degrees in our ministries that we're laying out there for people to consider adopting as well.
So, Sean, when you lay it out like that, it sounds to me as if you actually trust young people to be able to think substantively about these concerns. You expect them to be able to not only learn the theology and the practice of apologetics, but you actually expect them as young people to walk it out there. You don't expect young people to wait around for adults to come and tell their peers something. Talk about that, because that is really different than the way we have approached these conversations in the past. So inspire adults who are listening to have confidence that young people are actually ready for this kind of challenge.
Well, we've all heard the term helicopter parenting, this sense where we want to protect our kids from everything and every kind of harm, whatever that may be. I think that's a mistake. I've been working with students for really almost 2 decades. And what I found, generally speaking, is when I raise the bar, give them a challenge, give them something to do that's engaging and dramatic, they step up to it and they enjoy it and they love it. I mean, we're bringing in top atheists at Berkeley to speak to our students. We go door to door in Salt Lake City and talk to Mormons. These are not normal things students are doing, but we get dozens of students going on these trips. And they respond when we tell them, we go, hey, you can do this. This is going to be awesome. We're going to stretch you. We're going to push you. Then they start to live it out. In fact, one time when I was done, I had a kid call me on a Saturday afternoon. He goes, hey, can you answer this theology question? I said, sure. Why are you calling me? He said, well, we just got home and invited some Mormon missionaries over to have a spiritual conversation. I thought, this is awesome. Because they experienced it firsthand, they were willing to step up. So I would say have confidence in this generation. Push them, challenge them, and many, many will respond.
The book is So the Next Generation Will Know, Preparing Young Christians for a Challenging World. The co-authors are Sean McDowell and J. Warner Wallace. You can find Sean online at seanmcdowell.org. You can find J. Warner Wallace at casemakersacademy.com. So you're listening to Mornings with Carmen, and we'll be right back. So how are you processing and dealing with and interacting with all of the artificial intelligence afoot this day, moving very quickly into our lives at work, at the doctor's office, in the hospital, in terms of warfare? AI is here. And the question is, as Christians, how do we process that? How do we talk about it? How do we engage it? And how do we glorify God in and how we either adapt our lives to or resist adapting to, in some cases, emergent technology? That conversation up next with Hunter Baker from Union University. He and I will also talk about the removal of So Help Me God from oaths taken in congressional hearings. Okay, so yesterday I told you that many of you were living in a congressional district with a congressman named Colin Peterson who was opposing H.R. 5. That's actually not true. I mean, it's true that you probably still live there, but it's not true that he's opposing H.R. 5. In fact, he's a co-sponsor of it. So my bad. I take it back. That still doesn't mean you shouldn't pray for him. In fact, you should pray for him. Pray for him ardently. Still communicate with him how you feel about it. It's called the Equality Act, and it's bad. And they're going to vote on it on Friday, and it will be voted on absolutely down strictly partisan lines, which is super-duper sad. And so reach out to your member of Congress today. And you can always listen to prior shows. If you go to myfaithradio.com, you can listen to that conversation that we had yesterday here on air about the Equality Act. We touched on many components of it. We want you to be fully equipped for the conversations of the day. That's what we're doing here on Mornings with Carmen. You can get the former podcast of the show at myfaithradio.com.
So what does the Bible have to say about ethnicity and race? This is Jim Darlow. The Bible generally divides human beings into only two significant groups, those who know and follow Jehovah God and those who don't. It makes no distinction between skin colors, genders, abilities, or anything else. 1 Samuel 16:7 reveals, "The Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." These days, if you say there's only one race, the human race, you might be accused of microaggression. But Acts 17:26 affirms that, "From one man, God made every nation." The diversity we see today among people had its beginning only after God scattered humanity at the Tower of Babel. When you get well-versed in Scripture, you realize the truth espoused in James 2:9. If you show partiality, you are committing sin. This is Jim Garlow.
Hunter Baker from Union University. You're a dean, so even though it's finals week, you don't get to go home for the summer, or you already are home for the summer. You don't really get to take a summer break, but we're kind of glad for that because that means you'll still be here every other week with us to help us bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news of the day. So welcome back.
Thanks so much. Happy to be back.
We're glad to have you. Okay, I want to talk with you about Christians and AI or artificial intelligence. I want you to help us think through this together. It's obviously upon us, and as Christians, we are pro-truth. We're not anti-science. We're not anti-technology, but we are people who want to be discerning, and we want to be God-glorifying, and we want to be people who promote human flourishing, and we're not always exactly sure where those lines fall when technology is just advancing so rapidly. So I would love to walk through with you this statement on artificial intelligence by evangelicals. You actually helped craft it. And so let's just start with, what is AI?
That's a really good question, because, you know, I found that even as we were kind of in the room talking about it, there are probably different conceptions in people's minds. I would say that artificial intelligence, if we give it the broadest and most ambitious interpretation, is the idea of a machine of some kind that can think independently, that does not just purely rely on input from us, you know, or some sort of just preset decision tree, but actually has some capacity of judgment.
Mm. Okay, so when you say that, it sounds to me like you're talking about a machine that can think.
Yeah, that's the idea. Now, you know, it's really interesting to talk about it and discuss it. I'm not sure that such a thing will ever happen the way I've just described it. You know, our ability to reflect, to make decisions, to kind of consider courses of action. These are the things that this self-consciousness, these are the things that make us human and different from everything else in the creation. And human beings have sort of known that and reflected that and formed philosophies based on that throughout history. So I don't know if a machine will ever be able to do that. It's interesting to me that a lot of the heavy tech people, you know, if we were to go to Silicon Valley and ask, will that happen? I think a lot of them would say, absolutely, that's going to happen.
Okay, so this evangelical statement of principles on artificial intelligence, I'm going to direct people to find it at ERLC. That's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission.com, ERLC.com. If you just type in AI, this is what will pop up. It's an evangelical statement of principles related to AI. And Hunter, I really just want to walk through it. And
sure.
why is this? So this is described as existential, well, not an existential question, but actually existential questions posed by emergent technology, you know, that we call AI. So when we talk about existential questions, let's actually define that. What does that mean? And why is that sort of the location of this conversation?
Yeah. Basically, if we talk about something being an existential threat, right, you know, or an existential crisis, we're talking about something that could either threaten or radically alter the conditions of our existence as we know it. And that is what AI potentially could be, depending on how that technology is developed. And as you know, one of the things that's sort of known and understood in the world of artificial intelligence is that the ethics of the question are running behind the technology. And that was why we felt it was important at the ERLC to start thinking it through, right? To start asking ourselves sort of fundamental questions and where exactly is our compass pointing on these questions. So that's kind of what we tried to do.
So I appreciate that you guys established the foundation, which you do at the very beginning of this list of articles, the image of God, AI as technology, the relationship of AI and humanity. And then you begin what I would describe as the application of those principles to particular questions that people face today in the arena of medicine or bias or sexuality or work or data and privacy, security, war, and public policy. And then you talk about the future of AI. Let's take one of those issues. Anyone is fine with me. And let's apply sort of the principles in Articles 1, 2, and 3 to that particular issue? Because that's, I want to help people sort of understand how this is, how you do this. Because what you guys are really doing in this statement is demonstrating how we take biblical principles and apply them to contemporary issues and concerns.
That's right. I think that sort of there are a few overriding principles. Let's take the headline grabbing example. Some of the critics of the statement would say things like the evangelicals don't want sex robots. something like that. And that would be true, right? Certainly, you could imagine a combination of AI with really sophisticated materials science could create some sort of a, from a worldly perspective, desirable sex surrogate sort of a robot or being or something like that. And, we wanted to establish that that love and intimacy, these things are gifts from God and not to be cynically manipulated in this way. You know, that technology is not really an acceptable way to meet those needs or to fulfill that part of what it is to be human. And so we tried to address those sorts of questions, you know, whether we're talking about work or military applications or criminal justice, to kind of think through where is artificial intelligence potentially promising, where is it threatening, and you know, are there places we just should not go with it?
Okay, so now that you have brought up the topic, I'm going to actually put that on as an agenda item for our conversations in the future. I was at Q Ideas a couple of weeks ago, and there was actually a not just a talk, but then a panel discussion on the topic of sex robots. And I did not think that everybody adequately tilled that soil in terms of bringing the Christian worldview to bear. And so I would actually like to write that future headline with you on the show sometime. Like, we actually talk through that specific issue, because it's really not that far on the horizon for anybody who's sort of paying attention to what's going on around the world. And the ethical questions related to it are not just about marriage and the sanctity of the marriage bed. They're about all kinds of crazy things. So we're going to have to hold that subject matter, because I really today in the next few minutes that we have to talk after the break, I want to walk around in this headline out of Washington, D.C. that, you know, frankly, only made it to page 19 of The New York Times, which is that the phrase "so help me God" has been removed from the oath taking in several congressional committees. And so I just want to talk about that with you from an ethical perspective and in terms of where we're at this point in history in the United States. So I'm talking with Dr. Hunter Baker from Union University. We're talking at the intersection of ethics and frankly, the headlines of the day. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a minute. Returning to my conversation with Dr. Hunter Baker, I want to lift up a story that I read over the weekend. It was on page 19 of the print edition of The New York Times. Online, there's actually a different and better headline. So if you're going to look for it, the online headline is "So Help Me God, No More. Democrats Give House Traditions a Makeover." It's by Katie Edmondson. Here's what she writes. The witness rose from her seat, raised her right hand, and swore to tell the truth before Congress. But four words were missing: "So help me God." In the House of Representatives, to the winner goes the spoils, and Democrats, the new decision makers, control everything, including what legislation gets a vote and the minutiae of procedural choices, such as whether witnesses must utter the traditional plea for divine aid. Democratic chairman and chairwoman of several key committees have deemed no such entreaty is necessary, and they sort of outline why. So, Hunter Baker, what does it mean? First of all, let's just start with this. What does it mean to be sworn in as a witness and give sworn testimony? I think that's an important part of this conversation. And then we can move on from there.
Well, I mean, just establishing that you have a legal obligation to tell the truth, you know, in addition to your moral obligation. So a moral, legal, and maybe we'd say in the past a spiritual obligation to tell the truth so that your testimony would be considered reliable and valid.
And so I think that we could, you know, we could spend a whole segment together talking about, you know, what it would even mean to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in what we all regard as a post-truth era. But we're going to set that question aside, and we're going to really lift up the substance here. In your view, what does it mean to utter or to omit, so help me God, when somebody is sworn in?
Well, I think that the importance of including those words has to do with our acknowledgement of where political authority comes from. You know, I mean, some people look at it, and I think they think, oh, this is a cynical use of God, or this is a mere embellishment, you know, ceremonial deism or something like that. But when I think about "So help me God," or for that matter, you know, the national motto, "In God We Trust," I think about the reality that we get from the scripture that God establishes political authority, that it literally draws its valid and legitimate force from Him, that it has a job, that God has given us government to punish and restrain those who would do evil, to protect us. But when the government severs itself from God's authority, it is severing itself from that that legitimate, you know, that connection that gives it legitimacy. So, you know, governments throughout history have often been eager to sort of claim God's fatherhood. Now, you know, now what they do with that is another question, right? But to claim that yes, they recognize that they derive their authority from God. And so, you know, to the extent that we remove references like that, it's just sort of another example that we are, that we don't see ourselves as governing in a sort of a subsidiary way from God's authority.
So one of the observations that is made just in the very brief introduction to this article that I read is that to the winner goes the spoils, and elections do matter. What makes me sad about this is that that's then framed in terms of war. Have we reached that place in terms of our civil discourse where the two-party system is just actually open warfare?
Yeah, that's certainly the case. I mean, it's always been that way. But the thing that's different is this increasingly aggressive sort of secular element. You know, in Europe, you have had Christian political parties for a long, long time, the Christian Democrat parties. The reason they came about is because they faced aggressive secularism. In the United States, we really did not feel the need to do that because, you know, you don't have to go back that far to have Republicans and Democrats both eager to be seen as friendly to the Christian church and in fact, deriving their inspiration from God, you know, trying to sort of live with the grain of the universe to serve God, to do good in that sense. That's obviously changed. You know, there are many in our political system who sort of want to operate just purely from consent, right? The consent of the people, and to cut God out of the question.
So cutting God out of the question is actually where this conversation heads. But I want to I don't want to jump over this just really interesting note, because I think this is a misinterpretation of what's actually going on. But one of the things that that the author, Katie Edmondson, writes is that she suggests that the inclusion of "So help me God" is just this. Here's the phrase: the traditional plea for divine aid, or, you know, or an entreaty. I thought that, you know, at the end of the oath taking, that the reason that we were saying, so help me God, is to recognize that God is a witness. God is the ultimate witness. God is actually the one before whom I am making this testimony, even if in this moment I am making it in a court of law or before Congress. Do I have it wrong, or does the author of the piece have it wrong?
No, I think you're more correct. I have never thought of so help me God as, you know, God, please help me tell the truth. but rather that what's going on is that you're kind of, it's another way of saying, you know, as I stand here before you, before God, you know, I promise to speak truly. I think that's more, you know, essentially you're going to honor the command in the Ten Commandments to speak the truth and not bear false witness.
Hmm. Okay. And then finally, and I know we're completely out of time, but where this heads is that these members of Congress are saying, you know, they think God belongs in religious institutions, not in Congress. What does it mean for us to be at the place where we think we can relegate God to certain spaces and places and prohibit him from being present in others?
Well, exactly. I mean, who do we think we are, right? I mean, we act as though God is an accessory, and that's a ruinous point of view. And, you know, that's part of what the Christian public witness has to be, is to say, look, God will not be mocked. God will not be ignored. And that our public life together is going to be better to the extent that we are trying to follow the God of the universe.
Amen. Hunter Baker, thank you so much. Please come back again, even though it will be summer break. We need to hear from you. You help us understand what's happening in the world and bring the Christian or the mind of Christ to bear upon it, helping us not only understand Christian principles, but walk them out in the realities of life. So thank you so much for being with us today on Mornings with Carmen.
Thank you.
All right, friends, that is it. That's all the time we have in this first hour together. I'd love to hear from you. You can always text me at 877-933-2484. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. We want to hear from you. We want to know what's happening in your life and where you are having a challenge bringing the mind of Christ to bear. Continuing to pray this morning for the listener who has texted in and continues to face just tremendous spiritual warfare. Hey, we're praying for you. We are with you. We are for you. You are not alone. And so whatever you're facing today, you do not face it alone. You face it as a Christian, and you face it alongside other Christians. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.